Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Genius. Say the word out loud. Even today, more than 2,000 years after its first recorded use by the Roman author Plautus, it continues to resonate with power and allure. The power to create. The power to divine the secrets of the universe. The power to destroy. With its hints of madness and eccentricity, genius is a word bestowed on those with godlike qualities. So opens Darren McMahon's new book, Divine Fury, A History of Genius, which he'll be lecturing about at Rhodes College on November 13th at 6 p.m. Darren, I'm so glad to talk to you on Counterpoint today about the history of genius.
It's wonderful to be here, Jonathan.
Darren, I learned from your wonderful book that the origins of our celebration of birthday parties is actually a present-day echo of where the history of genius begins in the ancient world, since the ancestry of the birthday party is apparently the festum geniale, the annual rite and sacrifice to one's genius. How does blowing out the candles on the birthday cake take us back to the beginnings of the idea of the genius in the ancient world?
That's right. The word genius comes from the Latin genius, which is spelled exactly the way we spell genius. And a genius in the Roman concept was a sort of guardian spirit or a tutelary guardian who watched over all males from birth to death and who was celebrated every year on one's birthday. And so the birthday cake is believed as a sort of, you know, late survival of the offering that was made to one's genius on the birthday. Probably give them a little sweet cake and light a candle and some incense and say a prayer. And here's the birthday celebration.
So tell us a little bit more about the genius or the genius and how it operated within the ancient world. It was very different from our modern day understanding of the genius.
Very much so, although as I try to suggest in the book, there are some links. So the genius is a kind of guardian angel, and in fact the Christian guardian angel that develops after is probably in some ways a kind of outgrowth of this Roman concept. But really all cultures in all times have had ideas of spiritual intermediaries or spiritual guardians who watch over individuals and act as intercessors between individuals and the divine. The Romans had this concept, and they also had the idea that, you know, people of great souls would have great genii. And so the best example of this in the ancient world is Socrates, not a Roman, of course, a Greek, but the Romans think very seriously about what it was that Socrates had that made him the wisest of all men, as the oracle at the Temple of Delphi explained. And the notion was that, and Plato writes about this a little bit, that Socrates had a daimonion, and daimonion is the diminutive demon. And this is what the Romans called a genius, a particularly powerful guardian spirit who was in fact a kind of god, who advised him, who prevented him from doing silly things, and so therefore made him greater. And so the genius is a kind of outward manifestation of an inward greatness and also a special power that links us to the gods.
Now, one of the things about the ancient idea of the genius was that in actuality they did not create things anew. There was something different about the way in the ancient world they thought about the role of geniuses. Even someone like Socrates, at least if we get the picture of him from Plato and we think about Plato's idea of knowledge as recollection, this comes out. Tell us a little bit more about how that worked in the ancient world.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I like to point out to people is that really in all cultures, there's the notion that either the world has existed always and it was never created, it's always existed. And this is Plato's belief in the ancient world, and it's a belief of many other cultures. Or there's the belief, as in the Judeo-Christian conception, that the world was created at a certain point. In both ways of imagining the universe, there's the idea that everything that's created, every idea, every sort of invention has already been thought in the mind of God. And so to think, to create, is not to create a new ex nihilo from nothing. Only God does that. And in fact, in Christian theology, into the early modern period, you have this line, solus Deus creat, God alone creates. Individuals don't create, they recover, or they imitate, they find or discover. And in fact, I like to point out that those words, to discover or to invent, link to roots of to find or to remove the covering cloth. In other words, to discover something is not to bring something new into being, it's simply to reveal what was already there. And so the ancients have this idea very much so. In fact, the kind of dominant notion that structures ancient aesthetics as well as ancient ideas is one of imitatio or mimesis. We reproduce or recreate, if you will, the perfect forms that have existed in nature or by God's disclosure. We don't bring them into being.
And so one of the functions of the genius in the ancient world was to serve as this intermediary between the gods and man, and already then built into the ancient idea is that the role of the genius connects us to something divine. One might think that With the advent of Christianity, Christianity would completely define itself against the religious practices of Greek and Roman pagans, but you actually show that the pagan gods, the daimones or the genii, were actually rebranded by Christians, since alongside God the Father and God the Son were untold legions of angels and demons. So what happened to the category of genius in the Christian Middle Ages?
Christians come along, and of course they have to do something with these ancient pagan cults that have all these gods and all these demons, as you say. And so what they do is essentially rebrand all the pagan gods as demons. It's just that. It's a kind of evil beings, evil spirits. And yet they keep them in their sort of conception of the world. And so it's this irony that Christianity is, of course, a monotheism, and yet it has a kind of polytheistic element. There are all these demonic beings floating around. And during the late antique period and in the Middle Ages, philosophers, particularly those influenced by Neoplatonism, imagine the great chain of being, the sort of order of hierarchy that, you know, leads from the smallest created beings to all the way to God. And in that world, they have space for all kinds of beings, right? A genie and demons and whatnot, called in the Christian conception more often angels, although they use these other terms as well, who again fulfill this role of the ancients. They act as intermediaries and intercessors. The same is true of saints. Saints are, in fact, very much take the role of the guardian genius in the Roman conception. They watch over us from our spiritual birth until death, and they act as intercessors between God the Father and individuals. And so saints and angels and some of these other demonic beings still sort of stalk the Christian universe, and there's still a notion that one can get in touch with them in order to gain privileged access into the knowledge of God or the world as it is.
Now, one of the great things about the book, Darren, is that you not only trace the genealogy of the idea of genius, but you also have these wonderful vignettes all through the book about many of the people who were deemed to embody the idea of genius at a particular stage in the evolution of the concept. In the Renaissance, you explain, the spirits of the Greco-Roman and the Christian world were now slowly beginning to be identified with the men themselves. And Michelangelo was the exemplar of the Renaissance genius. Tell us about Michelangelo's consecration and how he fits into your story.
When people think geniuses, they often immediately think of the Renaissance, and there are good reasons for this. I mean, not only are the creators, Michelangelo and Leonardo and Raphael and others, astonishing, but in the 19th century, beginning in the Romantic period, there's an effort to sort of find the origins of a modern notion of genius in the Renaissance. And people like Michelangelo and others are held up as exemplars of a modern notion of genius. Now, I take pains to show that we're not quite there yet in the Renaissance. You still very much have this idea in the Renaissance of imitatio or mimesis. And so even somebody like Michelangelo is not seen as a creator in the modern sense or an original creator is bringing new things into being. And yet contemporaries don't know quite what to do with him, because not only does he imitate the ancients like many Renaissance artists, he surpasses them. And there seems to be something almost miraculous about his ability to produce art. And contemporaries describe this in the only terms that they can. They call him divine, or literally Michael of the angels, as if he's a higher being. Now, the ancient world had sort of two general ways of thinking about this kind of creation. Either great artistic or intellectual ability was infused into us by a ministering god or spirit or muse, and this is, in fact, Plato's notion of the divine fury, the divine mania or madness that takes over a creator in the act of creation, hence the title of my book. Or there's an idea that one is born with a natural ingenium, the Romans called it, literally the genius in us, a kind of natural capacity or capability. And what happens in the Christian period is that both these ways of thinking about artistic and intellectual achievement are sort of Christianized, and you can talk about ingenium as a kind of indwelling grace, a gift from God that's there from the beginning, or you can talk about great poetic inspirational achievement as being infused by the Holy Spirit or by an angel or by a saint or by God himself. And this is the way that contemporaries think of Michelangelo, is that he's a privileged being who's been given a kind of special powers in order to fully realize and express the beauty of God's creation.
So you've already told us that even by the Renaissance, the modern idea of genius hasn't really been fully birthed yet. And really the heart of your argument in this book is that the genius was a modern and a Western invention. It's constructed in Europe in the 18th century. Darren, why then and why there did this new type of being embodied by men like Isaac Newton and Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart come about?
it's a central question, and it's one that's sort of occupied scholars in the past. And I think there are all kinds of things going on in the 18th century, and any sort of development as complex as this is not going to be monocausal. So there are changes in the economy, there are changes in aesthetic notions, there are changes in the way that people think about artistic production. The two sort of contexts that I focus on are, one, religion, and two, the advent of a new belief in equality, ironically. The religious changes that I look at are, one, what the French philosopher Marcel Gauchet has called the withdrawal of God, the sense that the creator is not as present in day-to-day life as he once was considered to be. Not that God has disappeared or is gone altogether, but God has withdrawn from the world, ceding a kind of realm to mortals here below. In Gaucher's reckoning, this leads to sort of anxiety on the one hand, as people are, you know, feel somewhat abandoned and somewhat alone. But at the same time, it gives human beings a sense of agency, that they can control a world now that's been left to them to control. So that's one aspect of this religious change. The other is that all these beings that we've been talking about, these intermediary figures who from time immemorial have served human beings as intercessors between mortal life and the divine, angels and saints and prophets or genii and demons in the older pagan conception, they're being discountenanced. In fact, there's a very explicit critique of them that begins in the 17th century. Angels and demons are like fairies. They don't exist. So in that space then that opens up, between the withdrawal of God and the clearing of the heavens of angels and intermediary beings, you have a kind of conceptual space, I try to argue, in which human beings imagine a higher form of human being who in some ways can take on the role of some of these former higher beings. And so they act like secular saints, they act like modern apostles and prophets, and take on some of those kind of religiously charged powers beginning in the 18th century. So that's one major context. The other, ironically, is the advent of a belief in human equality. And it's this strange irony, as I say, that on the one hand, the 18th century gives rise to the birth of the figure of the genius, who's seen as unlike any other and superior, and it's a new model of the highest human type. And at the same time, you have, in 1776, you know, Jefferson sort of crediting it as a self-evident truth that all human beings are created equal. Now, we know that Jefferson doesn't really believe this, and he quickly sort of enumerates all kinds of exceptions to that general rule. So people of color and Jews and women and so forth are not accorded the same equality as others. And what I'm trying to show is that the genius serves as a kind of foil to this new belief in human equality, and also a kind of exception. An exception, however, deserving of more rights and more privileges, not less.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with Darren McMahon about his new book, Divine Fury, A History of Genius. Darren, you go on in the chapter that follows to say this about Napoleon. The name alone provides a working definition of the romantic genius. He's a prime illustration of the type. Why was Napoleon the ideal type of the genius in the age of Romanticism?
It's a really important question, and I would point to two things. One, I would point to what Napoleon himself does. Napoleon's a critical figure in my story, in part because he's really the first to fully appreciate that this new notion of genius, for which there's a huge cult in the 18th century, has political possibilities. And in fact, very self-consciously from quite early in his reign, he uses cult of genius to legitimate his power. And if you think about it, here's a guy who's obviously brilliant, but he doesn't have democratic legitimacy. He doesn't have royal or dynastic lineage to justify his rule. What does he have? Well, Napoleon has genius. He has the ability to walk into a room of crowned heads and to impress them. And he uses this both in the boardroom, but also in his propaganda, to create an aura around himself of a man who is higher than ordinary men, who has a kind of divine or fated fate in the world. So that's one thing that happens. And then the other thing that happens is that particularly after his imprisonment and death, romantic poets and philosophers and thinkers celebrate Napoleon as the new model of the creator. But he's a creator who doesn't create in paint or in words. He creates in flesh and human beings. He's destroyed centuries-old kingdoms and brought new kingdoms into being. He has striven for something greater than just ordinary life. He's the consummate individual. He's unlike any other. And so for poets like Byron and Shelley and others, and even Coleridge, who calls him the shaping spirit of ruin and is quite uncomfortable with Napoleon, there's nonetheless the sense that this is a man unlike any other and who is able to do things that no other human being can.
I think it's Hegel who calls Napoleon world history on horseback. And I think one of the interesting things about your book is that you show these figures who are emerging as these new kind of secular saints, if you will, or secular prophets, or people capable of changing history at a stroke through their very being. People like Isaac Newton, for example, are also constructed in their own individual moments, and their self-construction, their self-fashioning as a genius is important. That was true of Isaac Newton as well as Napoleon. Tell us a little bit more about the role that goes into the propaganda, if you will, behind establishing someone as a genius.
Part of being genius is being able to pull it off and convince others that you are a genius. I mean, there's a famous bon mot about Oscar Wilde when he enters the United States. It may be apocryphal, but he's asked if he has anything to declare at customs, and he said, "I only have my genius to declare." And, you know, some people can pull that off and others can't. Newton obviously had the goods, and yet he was also very, very good at, as you say, as creating an image of himself as a special human being in others. And so one of the things that he and his followers do are have his works reproduced very widely, or have images of him reproduced very widely. I mean, if you think about it, in the 18th century, before photography, it's often very difficult to know what somebody looked like, but there are all kinds of renderings of Newton that are reproduced cheaply and start showing up in people's homes, almost like little pictures or icons of the saints of old, public statuary and so forth as well. And so really there's a kind of group of disciples after Newton's death who sort of work on his behalf to perpetuate his image. And Newton then emerges in the same way that Shakespeare does. And one thing I point out about Shakespeare is that although, of course, he's an Elizabethan playwright and had been considered a great playwright for some time, it's only in the 18th century that he emerges as a genius and is sort of described as a genius and whatnot. But both Shakespeare and Newton, like the saints of old, are seen as embodying something quintessential about Englishness. They are Englishness itself, and yet they're also seen as beings or creatures unlike any other human being on the face of the earth. So this strange paradox, on the one hand, a totally unique individual who's also the kind of embodiment who can speak for a wider ethos, or in fact what contemporaries sometimes call the genius of the time, the spirits of the time. So when you mentioned Hegel before as being kind of the embodiment of world history on horseback, Napoleon, this is very much in keeping with this idea that somehow these special chosen individuals, these geniuses, can embody the actuating spirit of an age, just like a saint could be a patron saint for an entire country.
Now, your story is really a story set in Europe, but an American figure who became precisely that kind of embodiment, both of a nation and the spirit of a nation, but also the spirit of a time and of a genius, was Benjamin Franklin. Tell us a little bit more about the way in which Benjamin Franklin became the embodiment of quintessential Americanness, but also of genius.
My colleague Joyce Chaplin has written a very fine book on Franklin, points out that he's the first American genius, and he's spoken as a genius both in the United States, but even more so in Europe. And that, I think, is telling in its own right, that Franklin becomes a kind of genius for Europeans and the French even more so than the United States. And yet, even here, he's seen, as you say, as a kind of embodiment of all that's good and right in the American spirit. He is an entrepreneur. He thinks for himself. He's not pretentious, or at least doesn't come across as such. There's a kind of can-do optimism about him, as well as a wisdom. And these are qualities that I think Americans like to think of when they think of themselves. And that points to something important about the cult of genius. The geniuses often embody particular national traits or characteristics. A later genius in the American pantheon is somebody like Thomas Edison, who again is seen as very much a kind of self-starting individual. He doesn't have a formal education, and yet he's able to produce and create things of utility and value, and also to make money out of them. And of course, both Franklin and Edison make money out of their inventions. They're practically minded in this respect, an embodiment of a kind of American ethos.
You've given us a sense of how in the 18th century you begin to have the development of a process of the consecration of geniuses and the cultural function that they began to hold. And in the French Revolution itself, that became literal. There was a pantheon that was built in order to celebrate these great figures who were embodiments of a certain kind of ideal type. You've referred to this as the cult of genius a little bit. Now, I want to sort of flash forward in order to go backwards a little bit, because one of Hitler's historical models was Napoleon. You write that Hitler was able to assume his role convincingly owed as much to the reception of his audience as it did to his skills on the stage. The religion of genius was a precondition of Hitler's acceptance, the legitimating ground of the Führer cult. So tell us a little bit more about what you call the religion of genius, or that you playfully describe as genealogy, G-E-N-I-O-L-O-G-Y, the study right. of genius that prepared the way for Hitler's rise.
In Europe in general, but in Germany in particular, from the early part of the 19th century, contemporaries are conscious of a kind of religious-like quality to the cult of genius. And in fact, beginning in the 19th century and then very much more so in the early 20th century, scholars and analysts are using this term, the religion of genius, quite self-consciously. And they realize that the geniuses have taken on, as I say, some of these religious functions of older spiritual beings. They're seen to embody broader national yearnings. They're seen to have privileged access to the universe. They are able to see into our souls and see into the fabric of nature. They seem to have a prophetic quality in that they can anticipate that the spirit of the times and articulate it going forward. So this thought is developed very much in Germany. And Hitler, remember, is an art student originally, and he's very much kind of attuned to this, what the Germans call Genie-Gedanke, this kind of tradition of thinking about genius and genius thought. You know, quite skillfully, he presents himself from early on in this model. He writes about genius at some length in Mein Kampf, and he has the ability to impress upon those around him that he has something special. And he goes out of his way to seek the approbation and authority of important cultural figures. So a man by the name of Chamberlain, who's a cultural historian and a kind of important figure in German culture in his own right, sort of approves of Hitler early on and sort of writes of him and says publicly that, you know, this is the kind of embodiment of Germanness. This is in the 1920s after the war. And with this approbation and that of others, he's able to sort of present himself in this model as a savior, as a prophet, as an incarnation of the German people in a culture that has this reverence for these kind of figures and is thinking, you know, very self-consciously about them. He pulls it off in many ways. And as I point out in the book, when he comes to power and Goebbels and others are you know, working their propaganda, they continue to go out of their way to associate Hitler with sort of the geniuses of the German past. So Hitler goes to Weimar. He visits the house where Nietzsche died. He poses in front of the famous statue of Goethe and Schiller in Weimar. The Nazis make a whole series of genius films looking at the great geniuses of the German past and sort of making them Nazis, as it were. So it's quite self-conscious a propaganda effort, and in many ways is successful.
But it was more than just the religion of genius that was preparing the ground, since really a novel aspect of your portrait of Hitler is to show how race and genius were bound together. You state, "The genius of the race could only fully express itself in and through the genius of the great man, whose highest task was to revive, resuscitate, and reawaken the people's creative spirit." So how did Hitler weave together race and genius?
Since the 18th century and since the time when people have identified kind of genius as this power, this quality that makes human beings unlike any other, there's a scientific effort to try to isolate it, to try to sort of, you know, pinpoint what it is exactly that makes a genius a genius. And as I show in what you referred to earlier in the chapter entitled Genealogy, there's a kind of wacky science of genius in the 19th century. It begins with physiognomy, the effort to detect genius in facial expression, which has a long afterlife, and although we think of it as a pseudoscience now, it's important in the 20th century. It continues through phrenology, sort of the effort to read the bumps on the skull as an effort of an underlying genius. Continues in craniometry, and there's a whole effort to sort of ascertain brain size and shape on the basis of the skull. And then it continues in medicine and physiology, and then in eugenics, and in fact some attention in the book to Francis Galton, who is the cousin of Charles Darwin and who's the father of eugenics, but who's deeply, deeply interested in genius. His first and major work is called Hereditary Genius, and what Galton is trying to do is to figure out how many geniuses would be in any given population pool, and he arrives at a figure at 1 in 10 million. And so in Galton's reckoning, there's a kind of statistical and underlying scientific validity to the genius's special election. Now, Galton also believes that genius runs in gene pools. He doesn't have access himself to a notion of genetics, a modern notion of genetics, but he believes fully that that genius emerges in some places and not in others. And in fact, as I try to show in the book, much of this science, if not all of it, which culminates, I should say, in the IQ exam and intelligence quotient, much of the science is based in a racist or misogynist or anti-Semitic view of the world. So if you have a kind of continuum or spectrum of intelligence, you're going to find white European males on one side of it and then everyone else on the other. And so much of this genealogical science or genealogy is invested in a kind of racial view. And Hitler is heir to that. And he uses pseudoscience to give his rule further validation.
Now, Darren, you show how Einstein represented a significant antagonist for Hitler. This wasn't only because Einstein was Jewish, however, but because he represented a rival myth of genius that challenged Hitler's. Tell us how that was the case.
Right. I mean, this is another very interesting thing that Einstein emerges, of course, as such a compelling figure after the First World War. And of course, he has the goods, right? He is a genius, as it were, unlike Hitler. But his vision of the mind of intelligence is fundamentally different, whereas Hitler sees genius expressing itself only in racial lines and genius being akin to destruction, creation and destruction being bound up. Einstein believes that intelligence is universal, that intelligence should or ought to lead to toleration and peace and so forth. He's also, as you say, Jewish, and this is fundamentally important, at least in the Nazi conception, because for the Nazis and for Hitler in particular, Jews present a real problem, right? They present a problem because they're seen as poisoning the German race, but they're also a problem because they've been winning Nobel Prizes, at an alarming rates because they have identified themselves in IQ tests and other tests in kind of disproportionate ways. And this is something that Galton notices and comments on. He is anti-Semitic, and yet he says, look, they're disproportionately intelligent. And so Hitler and the Nazis have to do something with this. So one of the sort of discourses that you get is that the Jews are talented at borrowing other people's ideas, stealing other people's ideas. And in fact, this plays on a kind of insidious trope that you have from the 18th century forward, and that is that genius and talent are not the same things. Genius is born. It can't be learned. You have it or you don't. Talent is what you acquire through training, through practice, through theft. And so you still sometimes hear this kind of invidious distinction drawn about certain peoples who are not, seen as totally creative, but they're just talented. And this is the way that the Nazis describe Jews. And so for somebody like Einstein to win Nobel Prizes, to disclose the sort of fabric of the universe, to seem to expose and declare a reality is profoundly disturbing, and something has to be done with this myth. And so there's a whole effort, a Nazi effort, to discredit Einstein's science and to discredit him. They go after him quite explicitly from early on.
You recount at the end of your book the amazing story of the posthumous journey of Einstein's brain. It was stolen as a relic, and it is now available as a downloadable app, Slices of Einstein's Brain, which you say says a lot about the fate of genius in the contemporary moment, where today every innovator from Silicon Valley or footballers capable of moments of brilliance are all described as geniuses. So what does it mean about our culture that anyone can be a genius for 15 minutes?
Yeah, I mean, the story of Einstein's brain is a fascinating one in its own right. I mean, it was sort of taken against his explicit instructions and his will that he wanted to have his body cremated upon his death and then his ashes scattered in a secret location. The brain was taken and kept by the medical examiner at Princeton, and he couldn't part with it. And so he drove it around the United States and posted it in the mail. He stored it behind a beer cooler for a while. And then towards the end of his life, he started sort of letting out little samples of it to scientists. And every number of years, you'll see a new scientific report sort of declaring that, we have definitive proof Einstein was a genius because we've pinpointed this place in his brain and so forth. And frankly, I see this kind of research as very much an heir to the genealogical science of the 19th century. But as you say, Einstein's brain now is available as a downloadable app. And what I try to show is the way in which kind of market forces and democratic forces in the post-World War II era have taken the aura away from even something as powerful as a relic like Einstein's brain. The great French critic Roland Barthes wrote an essay in the 1950s when he says, Einstein's brain, it has this almost sacred power, and Einstein himself is heir to this older religion of genius, uses the power for the good, whereas Hitler uses it for the evil. And yet, by making his brain widely available, by speaking of geniuses as you say, anyone and everyone, we've robbed the concept of its special election and special power. And on the whole, as I try to argue in the book, that's been for the good. We no longer bow before idols in the way that we once did, and I think on the whole we're better for it.
But have we lost something there? I mean, in the sense that the great scientists, great writers, great artists, perhaps these are not seen as the kind of titanic figures that represent a certain set of ideals for us that we ought to aspire to. Isn't there a loss there?
I think so. I mean, and this is the paradox here that, you know, when you live in a world in which everyone can be a genius, strictly speaking, the genius can no longer exist. The figure of a vital exception no longer exists. And so we have many, many geniuses today. You can go to the genius bar at the Apple store and, you know, you probably know a genius. I try to show there's a whole self-help literature out there right now that's, you know, you too can be a genius. Discover your genius within. And yet when you flatten and deconsecrate the notion to such an extent, you're left with a situation, as you say, where we no longer venerate heroes and heroes of the mind in the same way that we once did. And I think, yes, that there is a loss associated with that.
Darren McMahon, thank you so much for giving us an overview of Divine Fury, for showing us that through tracing a concept like genius, we can get an overview of the whole cultural tradition that is ours, for a preview of what we're going to experience in more detail in your public lecture at Rhodes College on November 13th at 6 p.m. We really look forward to picking up the conversation then, but thanks for sharing it with us today.
Thank you, Jonathan. It was a real pleasure.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening.